Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello!
Hello! I've missed you.
I've missed you too. How was your summer?
It was really nice, actually. We had a really nice break. I've got so much to tell you.
Well, go on, tell me.
My big sort of breakthrough, drum roll.
That's me slapping my thigh. I don't know if it's quite a drum roll.
Slap my thigh. I'm a convert to bicycles. I mean, honestly, you deserve, like, massive credit.
Hang on. So you're talking about two wheels here. There were no stabilisers involved.
Two wheels. It all started with a sort of an electric bike hire. So sort of on our way to Italy, we stopped in a place called Châtel in the French Alps. And it turns out to be the mountain biking capital of Europe, which wasn't why we went there. But the only thing to do, really, was to hire a bike. And they had an electric bike, so I thought I'd try it out. And to be fair to you, you'd been wanging on about electric bikes might be the answer for me. I mean wanging on in the most complimentary way. And, you know, you were right.
It's quite something when you get on an electric bike for the first time. It's like sitting on a wild stallion. There's quite the jolt when you're not used to it.
Yes, I mean, it takes some getting used to it, and I sort of braking is a work in progress, because these were quite sensitive. These were quite heavy duty electric bike, but I mean, it means you can get up a hill anyway. But honestly, the most amazing thing is, which is kind of hard to believe maybe, is that when we came back, I was out there on the electric bikes, hiring my Lime bike and then using Justine's pedal bike.
What about all your fears, as previously discussed, about your own ability to balance, about traffic?
I did fall into a cabbage patch at one point, but
it's like something out of Last of the Summer Wine.
Yeah, it is, actually. But, I mean, it's a bit scary with traffic, but I've become more sort of used to it. You know what I mean? I've become more confident.
Are you using an app to plot out the quietest route?
Well,
I've
become quite, you know, it's will surprise you a lot, this, but obviously I've become quite obsessive about this now. And so I spent an hour online last night looking at the different cycle route you know, planners. So yes, that's the sort of, that's the thing. But honestly, I'm already planning this weekend sort of bike riding. I've become a sort of obsessive bike rider. It's sort of slightly weird.
No, that's exactly what happened to me at the beginning of the summer. I'll tell you what, City Mapper, I've found, is as good as any because it gives you the option of having quiet, regular,
yes,
or fast.
So does, there's one called Cycle Streets, I think, which is the main engine, I think. I don't know if it's the same. Maybe it's the same as City Mapper. That also has three options.
Well, I'll tell you who's going to be devastated about this.
Who?
Tricycle manufacturers.
I mean, honestly, they've all been queuing up for my sponsorship. I've been inundated. But I'm trying to work out now whether I buy an electric or a...
an acoustic.
Yeah, tell us about your holiday.
My big news is I was stung by a wasp.
No!
I've managed to live 47 years without being stung by a wasp or a bee.
Wow.
And then I accidentally trod on one by the swimming pool.
In bare feet.
In bare feet, yeah. Have you been stung by a wasp or a bee?
I can't remember having been... stung by
it. It's very easy to imagine you sort of fleeing through a field being pursued by a swarm of bees and trying to swat them off you.
I mean, just talking of nature red in tooth and claw, Justine and I went for this walk while we were on in Italy, and we saw, and I filmed, I hope this isn't going to get me into trouble, but I filmed a snake eating a toad.
Oh,
I mean, not, I didn't create the situation. But I mean, we were on this walk and I saw this toad and I said, Justine, there's this toad. And she said, why has it got a very long tail? I said, that's not the tail, that's the snake. And then we realized the snake was eating the toad. I wondered if I should, I was contemplating staging an intervention in order to try and save the toad, but I think it might have been too late.
I mean, what are the morals of that? You're there documenting.
Well,
the
exactly. I felt like David Attenborough.
Yeah.
I was thinking I could throw a stick at the snake, but Justine thought the snake might then attack us. And she thought that was a bad idea.
Again, much like the swarm of bees, this is a situation that is all too easy to imagine unfolding.
Exactly. Now, should we talk about what we're talking about?
Yes, but before we do, we've actually got a clip to play, which I think will set it up nicely. So have a listen to this.
I will not be lectured about sexism and misogyny by this man. I will not. And the government will not be lectured about sexism and misogyny by this man. Not now, not ever. The Leader of the Opposition says that people who hold sexist views and who are misogynists are not appropriate for high office. Well, I hope the Leader of the Opposition has got a piece of paper and he is writing out his resignation. Because if he wants to know what misogyny looks like in modern Australia, he doesn't need a motion in the House of Representatives. He needs a mirror. That's what he needs.
Yes. Well, look, we thought we'd sort of come back in with a bang, didn't we?
Yeah.
And we like having prime ministers and former prime ministers on this podcast. I thought I was going to make some self-deprecating remark about nearly prime ministers and former prime ministers, but this week we're talking to former Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard, who you heard in that clip, about women in politics.
And perhaps it's worth us saying, Jeff, that the then leader of the opposition that Julia is talking about is none other than Britain's new trade advisor, Tony Abbott.
Julia has written a fantastic book, which we strongly recommend, with former Nigerian finance minister Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala about women and leadership. They combine academic research with interviews with eight women politicians, including Hillary Clinton, Theresa May, Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, Joyce Banda from Malawi, Michelle Bachelet from Chile, and others. And Julia's co-author Ngozi leads the Global Vaccine Alliance, and she is in the running to be the new director general of the World Trade Organization. So she wasn't able to come on the show, but we had a great chat with Julia, both about how she got into politics and some of the conclusions from the book. And you know, we often think that we've made a lot of progress in women's representation, but one of the things that comes out in the book is only 57 countries out of the 193 in the UN that have ever had a woman as president or prime minister. That means 70% of countries have always been led by a man. So this is a really important conversation. Julia's got some fascinating insights from the politicians that she spoke to and about her own experiences.
And won't it be nice to have some cause for optimism around a former Australian Prime Minister?
Indeed. Indeed. We decided not to interview Tony Abbott. What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is a book I've just started reading this morning, and it's incredible. It's called The Gospel of Eels. It's by Patrick Svensson. And it's sort of part non-fiction about eels, which are just incredible creatures. They all come from the Sargasso Sea, and they start life as tiny, tiny specks. The currents bring them across the Atlantic Ocean into Northern Europe, from where they're slowly transforming. They're about as big as a willow leaf at this point. They go from being salt water to fresh water. They go up the rivers. They find somewhere to live in the mud on the bed of rivers, and then can live there for 30-50 years. And there have been occasions where, you know, marine biologists or whatever have moved them miles away, and within 2 weeks they go back to this place they've made the home. Anyway, after about 30 or 50 years or however long it is, they then decide they want to reproduce, and they go back across the Atlantic to the Sargasso Sea where they do it.
And, how extraordinary! You know, they were just specks
when they get, it's incredible. And that's so part of it's personal memoir of this guy and his memories of him and his father fishing for eels. But then, you know, I'm only sort of three or four chapters in, but Aristotle was fascinated by eels because at that stage there were all these theories about whether they just sprung to life, whether there were male and female eels. Sigmund Freud, as a young man, before he, you know, became fascinated by the mind, he was a young scientist who was trying to, there was this prize, basically the scientific community couldn't find a male eel. They'd found a female eel by this stage, but there was no evidence of male reproductive organs. So there were all these questions around eels, which have been slowly answered over thousands of years. It's brilliant. It's so good so far. It's called The Gospel of Eels by Patrick Svensson. What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is that, again, it's that I should offer thanks to you, because 2 or 3 days ago, I came out of the house to put some rubbish in the compost, as you do, and there was literally somebody standing there who said, "I really love your podcast, I just wanted to say." And I know that you made that possible, Jeff, because you wanted to make me feel good about being back in the country, and you got her to be there.
I did, you know, at great personal cost, because she was there for a long time.
She
charges by the hour, and she was hanging around your compost for a long time.
And she's a very nice young woman called Anna Barker, who teaches, I think she teaches sort of Greek and Latin in a school. And actually, you know, this is a sort of confession, really. I was so excited about the bicycles situation that I told her all about it. So you weren't really the first to know, podcast-wise, because I felt I should sort of share it with her. And she said, "Well, what happened to the tricycle?" And I said, "Well, you know, I've looked elsewhere."
It's the question we're all asking, Anna.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, our guest today has written a terrific new book. It's called Women in Leadership, Real Lives, Real Lessons, which is co-authored with Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, who sadly can't be with us because she has an important task to be getting on with. Maybe more of that later. But we're delighted to say hello to Julia Gillard.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
Well, it's great to be speaking to you, to hear your voice and see your face at the same time on my screen. And I mention that because I've spent a bit of time recently trying to get to grips with TikTok, which as a man in his 40s isn't easy. But I have heard your voice a lot recently, but not seen so much of you. One of your speeches has taken on a life of its own.
Well, you're a man in your 40s. I'm a woman in her late 50s. So when I started getting messages from friends that I was on TikTok, I firstly had to work out what TikTok was and how to have a look at it. And then I realised that they'd taken my misogyny speech from 2012, a number of young women in different takes were mouthing the words of it, miming to it, but with pumping soundtracks in the background and all sorts of animation in their face and their bodies. And I was very heartened to see it because they've clearly adopted that speech as a bit of an anthem for young women who know that they still go out in a world where they are at risk of being treated differently just because they're women. And they're taking a very upbeat, sassy kind of approach to it.
And it is this speech that went viral worldwide, one of the most famous parliamentary speeches. But just in case there's anybody listening to this who managed to avoid it, can you just give us the context of it?
This was a speech I gave in the Australian Parliament in October 2012, and it was a parliamentary day that was going to revolve around sexism. The Speaker of the House of Representatives had been shown to have authored some very sexist text messages. I had supported him to be elected as Speaker before any of this was known, of course, but I knew that it would be a parliamentary day where the opposition would be trying to say I was hypocritical about sexism. So I went into the Parliament ready for question time, and I took with me some of the Leader of the Opposition's most noted statements that were sexist in themselves. And I sat down expecting question time, but instead the Leader of the Opposition moved a motion of, you know, sort of censure against the government, gave a speech, and I, in the moment, had to respond. And it's that speech that's come to be known as the misogyny speech, where I put a strident view about how I had been treated in politics, including by the Leader of the Opposition, and how offended I was about that. And it's that that I think has continued to speak rather than the parliamentary context that it sprung from.
What is your relationship with that speech like? Is it like when a band has a very big hit and they eventually grow to be sick of it because it kind of defines them?
Well, I've certainly never been tempted to try singing it, though others have sung the misogyny speech. There have been various arrangements of that. In some ways, yes, I'm at peace with it now, but for quite a long time, I did have this feeling of, you know, I was in politics for 15 years. I was a minister. I was deputy prime minister. I was prime minister. And apparently it all telescopes down to one speech. And you were, you know, I was always there going, oh, what about, you know, the National Disability Insurance Scheme? What about some of our other big reforms? But now I kind of get it that the speech is going to have this ongoing life. It's very well known internationally. And many of the women who talk to me about it internationally don't know anything about Australian politics except that speech. And so if they're going to know one thing about Australian politics, I'm glad it's that.
Well, that's it then. We're done with that. I won't mention it again. we've boxed it off. Before we go into the book, I think we should spend some time just talking about your political career. What was your background growing up? What was it that took you from there into politics?
Well, I was actually born in the United Kingdom. I was born in Wales. My parents decided to migrate to Australia when I was a 4-year-old and my sister was a 7-year-old. So we're part of that great wave of British migration that came under what was called the Assisted Passage Scheme, the so-called £10 POMs, where you could migrate to Australia at a cheap price, provided you were a suitable migrant. And so I grew up in Australia in a home where politics was discussed. My father in particular was very interested in current affairs. He was an active trade unionist. But we didn't have a great insight into the inner workings of politics. And, you know, no one we knew was a politician or anything like that. My father was a psychiatric nurse. My mother was a cook in an aged care facility. And they taught my sister and I we should aim high. And unlike either of them, neither of them finished secondary school, we got to go on to university. So by the time I was at uni, I thought that was a very special place to be. And I first got involved in anything that looked like politics because there were some federal government cutbacks to education funding in my second year at university, and I got involved in the protest campaign against them. And that was kind of the start of everything for me, a realisation you could get involved and make a difference.
What you accomplished is astonishing. You made history. You went on to become the first female Prime Minister of Australia. When you think about the seed of, because there's a lot of ambition that is required to get from where you were to there. When you think about the seed of that ambition, and what is it? Even at that point in student politics, were you thinking, I could take this thing all the way to the top, or is it more incremental than that?
Much more incremental, because I didn't grow up with this touch with politics. You know, if you'd asked me when I was a primary school student or a secondary school student, would you think about going into politics one day? It would have just seemed as remote as saying, do you want to be, you know, an Olympic athlete or an astronaut? You know, ordinary people don't do things like that. And we're just, you know, an ordinary family. I'm just an ordinary girl. So, of course not. So it was incremental, you know, the student political experience gave me the sense that I could get involved, I could speak publicly, I could persuade people to a view, I could organise campaigns. And I came out of that increasingly thinking, this is what I want to devote my life to. I've got this taste for public policy now and making a difference. And so the penny dropped in my mid to late 20s that, yes, I would like to go into politics. And then in a very Australian Labor Party kind of way, maybe this might be a British Labor Party kind of way as well, between me realising the ambition, yes, I did want to be in politics, and me getting into the federal parliament was the journey of a decade where I was turned down for pre-selection on a number of occasions. And then I ran on the party's ticket for the Senate in what wasn't a good election for Labor and didn't get elected. So by the time I got there, I'd have to say I think it was sheer stubbornness that was propelling me through.
And is there, because, you know, you and Ed will have a very different perspective on this, but from somebody on the outside, basically I consume politics through the commentariat and the news and then also how it's reflected in pop culture. The position of the process of getting to the top is this chess game, this plotting that takes years. You know where you want to be and you sort of figuring out who you need to get on side. How much of that is true?
I think it looks more rational in hindsight than it does living through it on the way up. I mean, it more is, for me, it was more a journey of self-revelation about what you were capable of doing rather than this intricate game of I know that I want to get to the top. If you'd said to me when I was going into the federal parliament, you know, what's your ultimate ambition coming into this place? I would have honestly said, look, if I get to be Minister for Education or Minister for Workplace Relations in a federal Labor government, that would be every dream come true times 10. And then you get in there and you work hard, you learn, you get better at your craft, you benchmark yourself against your colleagues and you start thinking, you know, maybe I can do more of this, maybe I can aspire to a bigger role. And then, you know, you can have those thoughts, but politics is a matrix of skill, ambition, luck, timing, and all of those things have to come together to enable you to come through. And they did come together for me, fortunately. But, you know, it would have been well possible for me to have served my political career at another time in Australian history and to have spent all of it on the opposition benches. You know, you only need one thing to be slightly different and then the whole thing, sort of, in some ways falls apart. There are many pathways for people in politics and it's not just about individual skill, it's about all of these intangibles as well.
Well, let's talk about the book. It is Women and Leadership. How did you and Ngozi come to write the book? Where did the sort of germ of the idea come from?
I got to know my co-author, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, who is a former finance minister and foreign minister of Nigeria. I first met her actually at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, which Australia hosted here in Perth when I was Prime Minister. But we really got to know each other in the years since. I went on to chair the Global Partnership for Education. So this is the major multilateral fund that supports school education in developing countries. And Ngozi chairs the Global Vaccine Alliance, so a very important job right now in our world. And we'd be at all of these international meetings together. We formed a bond, a friendship, and we started talking about what we'd experienced and what we were seeing for women in leadership around the world. And we were frustrated when we continued to see how gendered their experiences were. And then Hillary lost, and we said to each other, we've got to try and do something. What are we going to do? And out of that came the idea of putting the book together.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And how did you talk to us about how you chose the women you spoke to for the book, the leaders? Because it strikes me that, you know, something you were very keen to do was make sure they were from across the political spectrum.
Yeah, the first kind of big decision we made about the book is we wanted it to bring the academic research that there is around women and leadership. We wanted to take that research and test whether women who were leaders thought that the research was right or wrong. Did they feel its power in their own lives? So having made that decision, then we thought, which women? And we wanted to get a big global spread, people from very different contexts and cultures, and we wanted to go across the political spectrum, so conservatives and progressives.
And do you want to run through the women that you talked to in the book for us?
Sure. So in terms of women who have been or are serving as presidents and prime ministers, we spoke to, in my region of the world, Jacinda Ardern. We spoke to Michelle Bachelet from Chile. We spoke to Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who was the first woman to lead a nation in Africa. She led Liberia. We spoke to Joyce Banda, who led Malawi. We spoke to Theresa May, of course, from the United Kingdom, and Erna Solberg, who is Prime Minister of Norway. And then we added two other women who haven't served as presidents or prime ministers, one of them, Hillary Clinton. So, of course, many of us, including me, very much wish she was serving as president. And the last was Christine Lagarde, who was in French politics but went on to lead the International Monetary Fund. And we thought she'd have a particular perspective because as head of the IMF, she went to a large range of international meetings where heads of government and heads of state gather.
And pretty much off the bat in the book, you set out some shocking figures on the lack of women in leadership positions. Do you want to, I think, you know, it can be shocking seeing it laid out like that. We think we're further on than we are. Do you want to just paint a picture for us of where we're up to in terms of gender equality in politics?
I'm worried I'm going to depress you, but the statistics do need to be looked straight in the face. So if we look around the world, 70% of countries have never been led by a woman. And there are only 13 countries that have been led by a woman more than once. And there are only 2 countries in the world that have had 3 women leaders. One of them is Iceland and the other is New Zealand. Jacinda Ardern is the 3rd woman to lead. So they're pretty bad statistics. Now, if all of this was changing really, really quickly and you were seeing a rapid rate of growth in the number of women leaders, you might think that this was a short-term or medium-term problem. But the World Economic Forum tells us that at current rates of change, it'll be almost 100 years before we see equality in political leadership. So if we want to live to see a more gender equal world, then we're going to have to absolutely pick up the pace.
And I mean, Julia, there's so much to talk about in this book. And what I really love about it is it combines the very interesting anecdotal interviews with the more academic analysis, and you then boil it down into 8 hypotheses. And I just thought we should maybe talk about some of them. So this is perhaps in a way the most obvious, but that doesn't make it any less important. This question of appearance and women leaders being scrutinized so much more for their appearance than men. Talk a little bit about this, what you went into the book thinking, what you found as you talked to the 8 leaders and looked at the academic research.
Yeah, on this question of appearance, at one level, everybody would say, yes, of course, you know, women do get much more scrutiny on their appearance. That's true in real life, whether you're, you know, walking down the street, going to the local shop, and it's also true in politics. And we tried to delve a layer beneath that. So there's the, you know, women are still unusual on the political stage, so people look at what they're wearing. There's no standard uniform for women the way there is for men, wearing a suit and tie and shirt, or depending on context, traditional dress, like Prime Minister Modi wears an Indian style of garb. But then we wanted to go a little bit deeper and say, and do people make more judgment calls about women? Do they think what they're wearing and how they appear says something about character? And we couldn't absolutely answer this with precision, but I did have a fascinating conversation with Theresa May. And if you look at the current Prime Minister in the UK, Prime Minister Johnson, you know, he's well known for you know, slightly eccentric, you know, appearance. He clearly isn't in possession of a hairbrush, and all of this is received, you know, as a kind of I think it's received generally as a sort
good
of
old Boris, yeah,
and eccentricity, something, yeah, you know, basically sort of endearing about, yeah, an individual and endearing. And we talked to Theresa May about whether a woman who looked like she didn't own a hairbrush and routinely had, you know, bits of a camisole coming untucked or something, how would she be received? And Theresa, you know, thought about it and ultimately said, you know, she thought a woman like who appeared like that may even have had difficulty being pre-selected by the Tories, you know. So I think that's quite telling.
And what's quite shocking is that you quote research saying the media focused more on Theresa May's appearance than on Mrs. Thatcher's appearance when she was Prime Minister. I mean, does that mean it's getting worse?
Yeah, a wonderful young Australian researcher called Blair Williams did a comparison of the media coverage of Prime Minister Thatcher in the 2 weeks after she became Prime Minister back in 1979 versus the first two weeks for Theresa May, and found the coverage is more gendered now. Now, I don't think that that is telling us that we've gone absolutely backwards on gender standards. I think it's telling us that there's a loss of politeness and reserve in the modern media.
Yeah.
So, you know, they will say things now that they wouldn't have out of a sense of decorum when Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister.
Yes.
For example, that photograph of Theresa May speaking to the Scottish leader, to Nicola Sturgeon, and they've got their legs,
yeah,
you know, they're both wearing skirts and they've got their legs crossed, and the headline, you know, "Don't worry about Brexit, who won Legsit," you know, who's basically got the better legs. I don't think anybody would have put that in the newspaper in 1979.
Appearance is merely one element of the challenges that the harsher standards that women leaders are judged by. Talk to us about shrill or soft and the style kind of question.
Yeah, we looked at the academic research about how people view women leaders, and we recount some of it in a chapter called Shrill or Soft, as you say, but we've got another chapter where we push it out and leave it a little bit further entitled She's a Bit of a Bitch. And we based all of that on research which shows that because we still, all of us, have gender stereotypes whispering in the back of our brains, we've still got a little voice that tells us to expect men to be ambitious, self-seeking, commanding, you know, that style of leader. And if we see a man doing that, it accords with our stereotype, so that's fine. If we see a woman doing that, we find it disturbing, even offensive, because it offends against our stereotype that women are nurturing, empathetic, put the needs of others in front of the needs of self. And this plays out in the conclusion that a woman who is like that is, you know, not likeable, not nice, prickly, hard to deal with, and basically the sort of leader that as a voter you'd be unlikely to support. And when you think about Hillary Clinton's campaign, ultimately failed campaign, she went into that with people identifying that her single biggest problem was that people didn't think she was likable. And whilst you never get to run the control test in politics, and you never get to say if a man had exactly Hillary Clinton's past, how would he have been perceived? Obviously, you can't do that. But I imagine a male Secretary of State, even with the emails, even with the issues around Benghazi and the security of the US embassy, people might be saying about that man, look, I'm worried about emails or Benghazi, I'm worried about these on questions of competence. But I don't think people would have been wandering around saying, you know, the problem with this bloke is he's not very likeable.
Yeah.
I think that's about gender.
And talking from your own experience and maybe the leaders you interviewed, how do women leaders navigate this conundrum? How can they navigate this conundrum?
Each of them intuitively felt that there was a pathway they had to walk where they appeared strong enough so people thought that they had what it takes to lead, but they also needed to appear empathetic. And they sort of intuitively knew if they fell one side or the other, you know, too strong or too caring, that would be a problem, that people would think, too strong, not likeable, too caring, she's too much of a softie to lead the nation. And all of them talked, and this is, you know, across very different cultures and contexts, all of them talked about self-limiting some behaviours because they were conscious of this, like second guessing, you know, what would happen if they cried, for example.
What would happen if a man cried, do you think? A male leader?
I think because it's against stereotype, I actually think it can be received well. In I think it depends a bit what you're crying about. But yeah. In politics, when I've seen men moved to tears because of, dreadful natural disasters, loss of life, they're trying to convey that news to their nation and they've been moved to tears, people have received that as an outpouring of empathy that was appropriate to the occasion. I felt this in my own experience, mostly in Australian politics, not always, but mostly in Australian politics in, contemporary times, and by that I mean the last sort of 30-odd years, when male prime ministers have left the prime ministership, they've lost a leadership ballot or they've lost an election, they've shed a tear. When that happened to me, I was 100% determined not to, because I really did think there would be categories of people that said to themselves, I knew it, that I knew these women wow. weren't up to it, I knew they couldn't wow. take it. So I steeled myself to not do it. And I don't recall there being a strong adverse reaction when any of the men did it.
Now, talk to us about the issue, and this is something that came up in Theresa May's campaign to be leader, about women as mothers or not being mothers. And I think there's a Hillary story about Hillary saying that, which I was really stuck with me, where she says that I think somebody wrote to her saying she was advised that if you're a man, a father, it's good to have pictures of you and your kids in the office because you'll be seen as a nice guy. Whereas if you're a woman, a mother, it's better not to have the pictures of your kids because you'll be thought to be, you'll be spending all your time thinking about your kids and not concentrating on your work. How does this play out with women leaders?
Yeah, Hillary did tell that story in the book, and it's a story right from back when she was a young emerging lawyer, and she remembered noting that advice, which was given in a sort of agony aunt column in the newspapers. And we tried to explore what does it mean if women do and don't have children as leaders. And basically, we came to this proposition, Ngozi and I, with different experiences. I don't have children, Ngozi does. But we had concluded, both of us, that there was basically no right answer for a woman in politics to the question, do you have children? Because if you say no, then people think, oh, you don't really get what family life is about. You don't really understand. And all of those images of self-seeking, career girl all come to the fore. Whereas if you say, I do have children, then the next question is sort of, well, how are you going to manage this? I mean, how are you going to end up going to Canberra or going to Westminster? I mean, who's going to be looking after the kids? And these are questions that men in politics, even with young children, don't get asked because people are just assuming that there's someone at home who's making it all happen for them. So we did explore that, and we explored how the women balanced it. Most particularly, we looked at the experiences of Jacinda Ardern, who is the second leader after Benazir Bhutto to have a child in office. But we then tried to look at my experiences versus Theresa May. Theresa May doesn't have children. She and her husband would have very much liked to, but they were unable to. And that was basically, in her view, treated very respectfully by people. But, of course, there was the incident when she was campaigning for leadership of the Tory party when it was raised by a female opponent to suggest that she didn't really have as much of a stake in the future because she didn't have children. Now, fortunately, that statement was viewed as so abhorrent that it was a trigger point for that candidate against Theresa to leave the race. I compared that with my experiences. I don't have children by choice. And that did become a thing in Australian politics. There was a crazy media flurry about me being photographed in my kitchen and not having fruit in my fruit bowl. What sort of woman, what sort of human being doesn't have fruit in their fruit bowl? How can one possibly understand the needs of a nation if one is unable to buy fruit? On and on it goes. And no amount of saying, it's not a fruit bowl, it's a decorative bowl, it looks better if you can see the bottom, ever fixed that. And I was chided by a Conservative senator for being deliberately barren, something that he ultimately had to apologise for, but only very begrudgingly after a few days had gone by.
I mean, it's very striking, just as you're talking, that Boris Johnson has just had a child and nobody is saying, well, how can Boris Johnson, you know, do his job and, you know, have a new baby? You know, I mean, it's like literally the question is not even asked. Whereas the minute Jacinda had her baby, it was the only question that was asked, I guess.
Yes, that's right. And we looked back in British politics because, of course, Tony Blair had a baby when he was Prime Minister. David Cameron had a baby when he was Prime Minister. And we did try and look to see whether there was any questioning of them. And from the media at the time, there was just, you know, a nice sense of, you know, community interest. You know, it's a nice, always a nice thing to see a new baby in the world. So people were full of hearty congratulations, but no sense whatsoever that they would somehow be stopped from being able to do their roles as Prime Minister.
Given all the challenges, and you talk about them in such a compelling way that female leaders face, let me ask you a sort of slightly different question, because it's come up during COVID, and there have been a number of articles that I've seen that say, you know, it's not a coincidence that the countries that have handled this best have female leaders. And I know that there's, you know, that's just a kind of anecdotal thought, but it just takes me to a more general question, which is, do you think there is a different way that women leaders lead, or is that in itself a kind of gender stereotype?
I am not a believer that men and women inherently have different leadership styles. We actually look at male and female brains in the book and end up concluding that a lot of this, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus kind of stuff is neurosexism, not neuroscience. Sure. But women and men are socialised differently, and women in particular receive all of the signals that if they aren't, you know, communitarian enough, if they aren't looking after others, if they aren't focusing on the team, then that's viewed as unacceptable. And then women leaders are conscious of this narrow pathway of strength and empathy. And so I think by the time you factor all of that in, it's no surprise that the women that we see leading tend to be women who are leading in that strong, empathetic style. And I do think that's a style that people have responded to well during the pandemic, because they want to know that the person leading their nation has got this, that they are, you know, tough enough to bring the nation through. But they also want to see that the leader gets it, in the sense of gets how anxious, stressed, confused, you know, very frustrated, wondering about the future communities are. So they want to see that warmth as well.
Which brings us on to, I guess, the question of women as role models. Talk to me about balancing the importance of just seeing a woman in a leadership position, you know, just that inherently having value as a role model, versus a woman in that position who also does a lot for other women. And I suppose Margaret Thatcher is the example that springs to mind, that it was very important, I think, for so many young women and girls to see a woman in a position as Prime Minister. But she's not somebody who really prioritised women's issues.
I remember, you know, I remember when Margaret Thatcher was elected, and it made an impression on me. I was in 1979. I would have been 18 years old, And it made an impression on me that there was a woman running a country as important as the United Kingdom. And it made an impression on me, even though I had zero sense of attachment to her politics. I mean, you know, with my father coming from South Wales, you can imagine the adjectives that went in front of the noun Thatcher in my household, and they aren't for repetition on a podcast.
Go on. No,
then this will come out beep beep beep, and I don't think we want that. But just the sheer role modelling that, wow, you know, like a woman can be prime minister, like I haven't seen that before. So I think it does matter, but you know, role modelling is important. But we dig a bit deeper in the book and we talk about how role models can be most impactful and how girls need to not only see a woman, but it makes the biggest impression if they see a woman who shares characteristics with them. So, you know, to take a very clear example, if a young black girl constantly sees white women, then the message she might get is not that this is a pathway open to her, it's a pathway open to women who are not like her. And then we also talk about how to be the best role model, you've got to steer a line between not coming across as superwoman, but not only putting the barriers that you face. There are joys and delights in leadership. It is absolutely worth aiming and going for, but there will still be some gendered bits, and not insult women's intelligence by refusing to talk through them.
And given that you talk to women across so many different countries and cultures, how universal do you think the challenges faced by women in leadership are?
It is remarkable to me, and is one thing that I really learned in the book, that these challenges are far more similar than I would have thought at the start. I'd never fallen for, you know, the slick argument that gets put in countries like Australia and the UK, and you would have all heard it, where feminists end up having a retort given to them of, oh, I don't know what, you know, you're complaining about here in Australia or the UK. I mean, you know, you basically get it easy. I mean, try actually doing life somewhere where it's tough, where girls don't get to school, where there's child marriage and that kind of stuff. So I'd never fallen for any of that, and I don't think that we should. But I did expect culture and context to mean more differences than we saw. We saw more similarities on how sexism plays itself out.
The book also tries to say, what can we do about the absence of the massive underrepresentation of female leadership? And you also give some advice for what men should be doing as allies in this struggle. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we do conclude the book with what we entitle the standout lessons, and there are some there for women who are aspiring to leadership, whether that be in politics or in any other walk of life, and we hope they find them useful. But we've got a very specific message for men as well, which is that men can make a huge, indeed disproportionate difference to the struggle for gender equality. The research very clearly shows that if a man points to sexism as a problem, that he will be listened to, he will be seen to be raising that not because it's in his personal interest, but because it's genuinely a problem. And not only will he be listened to, a man in a corporate environment that gets a reputation for being the one who is prepared to do that is seen as having leadership qualities and the ability to put the interests of others first. And that's been shown to lead to promotions and the like. So for men, this is all upside. A gender equal world would be a better place to live, and you can actually be rewarded for being a guy who does the right thing.
I have a last question, which is the title of the podcast is Reasons to be Cheerful. and this shouldn't be sugar-coated, but give us a picture of the sort of what the progress you think you've seen during your political career and whether that gives you hope.
Looking back on my life and my political career, I do see many reasons for hope that we're going to create a better world and that we can bring new tools and new ways of working to the task. You know, across my lifetime, whether it's politics, whether it's business, we've seen more women come through. We've seen more understanding develop of the barriers in women's way. And I actually think we've got far greater community consensus now that those barriers need to be cleared. So all of those things coming together gives me huge optimism about the future. This is a task we can get done. You know, my own lifetime has seen so much change. If change has been possible as I've lived through these years, then I'm very, very certain that if we've got the will, then we can find the way to accelerate the rate of change.
Well, look, Julia Gillard, the book is Women in Leadership, Real Lives, Real Lessons. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So what did you think?
Well, firstly, I thought it was a brilliant conversation. She is so compelling to talk to.
Yeah, definitely.
It was one of those conversations as well where you have to check your male privilege a little bit, because your assumption is things just get better. And one of the stark facts for me was when they did the analysis of the coverage of Theresa May and her appearance, that it was actually worse for her than it was for Margaret Thatcher in the 80s. And so, you know, there's an indication that perhaps things, you know, aren't necessarily getting better in the way that we all think they are.
I think you're right. I mean, you know, in a sense, there's the sort of, you know, stark facts that we referred to at the beginning on representation, how many female leaders there have been. And then there's the all of the implicit and explicit sexism and all that. It's funny, I thought of this this week because the Shadow Cabinet is now meeting again in person, and we meet in a committee room in the House of Commons. And at one point in the meeting, I sort of gazed around the walls and I realised that there were probably half a dozen paintings on the walls, all of them of men.
Of course, yeah.
Groups of men, men on their own, you know. And it sort of is interesting, isn't it? I mean, that's just a sort of, well, it's always been like that. This is a sort of historical thing, but that's just a subtle example of the kind of assumptions that we all live with. And in a way, that's just one very, you know, particular example, but there's lots of those examples. Do you know what I mean?
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet @cheerfulpodcast.
Well, we're in the outro. I think we should underline the fact that if people have thoughts on what they've heard from Julia Gillard, ideas for future episodes, we're really beginning the autumn term, very keen to hear good ideas from around the world, from Britain, that we should be featuring issues that need solutions. Then people should email us. They can find the way to do that by going to our website, cheerfulpodcast.com. You can also sign up for our brilliant newsletter there. You get the extra bonus bits, don't you?
Lot of detail. If you want to do, I think they call it a deep dive.
Yeah, but we'd love to hear from you. And we read every email, don't we?
We do.
Even the nasty ones. Particularly the nasty ones. But there aren't that many nasty ones.
No, but we really obsess about them.
And can we also just talk about things we obsess about, which is lots of things. People need to review and rate us, don't they? 5 stars, please, on your platform. Push us up the... I mean, you know, algorithms are in the news. I'd say the podcast charts are a pretty mutant algorithm, but, you know, people should sort of, you know, push us up the whatsamajigs.
Top of the pops. I've got a little bit of news for you.
Oh,
my son, in the last couple of weeks, has become obsessed with Octonauts. Now, do you know why I mentioned
this? Yes, because my children were obsessed with Octonauts.
when I first met you, when I interviewed you in the run up to 2015, I finished with a softball question about your kids and policies, and you closed it down with, I think they're more interested in the Octonauts. And here we are, full circle, all these years later, my son's got into them too.
Captain Barnacles.
Yeah.
Captain Barnacle, sorry. Quasi. Tunip and the Vegemals.
Is there a penguin?
Peso the Penguin. I'm struggling with the other
ones. I think there might be one called Tweak, or does that sound right?
Yes, Tweak.
If they ever want us to go on a podcaster's edition of Pointless Celebrities, Ed's really good at naming Octonauts.
I want to mention something which is not to do with the Octonauts. My friend, if that's not a name drop, Ronnie O'Sullivan won the World Championships, and I was so delighted for him.
In some ways, it's like you have won the World Championships vicariously.
Yeah, that's what I felt. He was incredibly nice to me during the election. He came and canvassed with me, came and did some stuff, and canvassed. And he's a top bloke. And to be honest, I find it incredibly nerve-wracking watching him. So I just find it too nail-biting to watch him. But honestly, I'm really, he sort of really, you know, he it's been, I think, 7 years since he last won, and it's been a big thing for him. So I'm really pleased. Is there anything else to be said?
I think that's everything, isn't it?
Yeah.
Looking forward to the September, autumn and beyond.
I'd like to thank Julia Gillard for joining us. She's obviously not only the former Prime Minister of Australia and has written this book, she's also a podcaster, and her podcast is called
A Podcast of One's Own.
So look out for that.
Emma Caution produces our podcast, and I should say a belated happy birthday to Emma. She had a big one while we were away for the summer, one of the ones ending with a zero. So many happy returns belatedly to our beloved producer. Joel Pearce does all the research with backup from Fanula DC, Zoe Gelber and Joe Kenyon. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made our idents. The music was composed by Ed Seed, and our artwork was designed by
Henry Cole. He's been Jeff Lloyd.
He's been Ed Miliband.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author Elizabeth Gilbert about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.